his latest book, Dr. Peter W. Singer writes about a revolution taking place on the battlefield in robotics. Robots are increasingly being used, especially by the United States, in combat zones around the world, and their appearance is beginning to change how wars are fought. Dr. Singer has worked in the Pentagon, is currently a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. The book, Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and the Conflict and Conflict in the 21st Century, is published by Penguin Press. Very pleased to welcome Peter Singer to the show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
You write that the changes taking place in robotics represent a revolution for the field. Has this revolution been accelerated by the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, or would it have happened anyway?
Most definitely it's been accelerated by it. It created the customer pull, so to speak. To just give you a sense of the numbers, we went into Iraq with a handful of these unmanned drones in the air. We now have 5,300 of them. On the ground, we had zero in the invasion force. We now have 12,000. So this is something historic. And when I say a revolution, we're not talking about a robots revolution like, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger showing up at your door a la the Terminator. We're talking about a revolution in history in terms of how we fight, the same way the atomic bomb was a revolution or machine guns were a revolution. But with robots, there's an added twist. It doesn't change just how we fight. It changes who fights.
Well, in some cases, the robots themselves, but in other cases, you mentioned the drones. Some of those unmanned drones operating in Iraq and Afghanistan are guided thousands of miles away by pilots in the United States, in Southern California.
In Southern California, and there's another big base right outside of Las Vegas. And so you have this weird psychological disconnect of people being at war, but they're actually physically at home. And they talk about this as being a huge challenge of, you know, you get in your Toyota Corolla, you commute into work, you're shooting missiles at enemy targets for 12 hours, and then you get back, you commute home, and you're sitting at your dinner table with your kid talking about their homework.
Or going to the PTA meeting, one says.
Yeah.
Is that disconnect a bad thing?
The concern is that it might make us more likely to use force. It also might potentially make war crimes more likely. It's very hard to remind people that this isn't a video game, that this is real. And the commanders of these squadrons who I met with, they said, look, you know, we found it harder to be a commander of a drone squadron than of a regular squadron. And in fact, the PTSD rates are higher for the drone squadron pilots than the other way around.
Even though they're living at home.
Yeah. They talk about it being tougher because, you know, you're still at war, but then you have your wife at home saying, you know, why didn't you fix the toilet?
But a lot of this is like video game, isn't it? One of the most popular robots now being used by the U.S. soldiers is the PackBot. And it does help if the soldier has some experience with a PlayStation.
Most definitely. And the PackBot, a lot of people find this interesting. It's made by iRobot, the same company that makes the Roomba, the little robot vacuum cleaner. So iRobot is a very interesting kind of company. It may be the only one that sells both to Linens and Things and the Pentagon. And the controllers for these are modeled exactly after the PlayStation controllers. And there's a reason. The military is basically free riding off of the video game industry. They're designed well for your hands, and you already have a generation of kids trained up in their use when they join.
And what is the PackBot do?
The PackBot, it started out being just a reconnaissance robot, hunting down using a distance television camera. Then it became an EOD bot. That is, it would help defuse bombs, these roadside bombs that were taking so many lives in Iraq. It helped break that problem. And then, of course, like what happened with airplanes back in World War I, it's first used for reconnaissance, and then someone says, why don't we arm it? And so there's a new model of the PackBot that actually packs a shotgun.
And today, iRobot announced that it has received a $5.5 million order from the U.S. Army for its PackBot.
It's sold several thousand.
That doesn't seem like all that much.
That's just a drop in the bucket to the contracts they have. This is a company that started out being three graduate students in their den and is now listed on the New York Stock Exchange. And it sort of shows you the growth factor that we've seen since 9/11.
And you can only think that this is positive because it cuts down on human casualties.
That's the positive in one way, but there's a flip side to this. What does it do to our democracy? And so I went around the last several years interviewing everything from the robot scientists to the four-star generals to politicians on both sides. And what was fascinating is there was a shared concern across all of them. And it was the idea that it was going to both save lives but also maybe make us more cavalier in the use of force. One Reagan-era Pentagon official put it this way. He said, "I'm a big supporter of these because there's hundreds of Americans who are alive today because of them, but I'm afraid there's going to be more marketization of war, more shock and awe talk to defray the discussion of the cause."
Because if we're not concerned about loss of life, we can invade another country and assume that, just as in the past, we could achieve a lot through air power, airplanes which were unlikely to be shot down. Now we can do it with these robots and nobody's going to die. And the people controlling them can be pretty far away.
Exactly. And I think what it does, it takes trends that are already in play and puts them on steroids. So right now you have no draft, you have no war bonds, we don't even declare war anymore. And then you add in this new trend that has more and more of the Americans being moved out of harm's way, and so you have the bars to war being lowered and maybe taken all the way to the ground. And there's one last thing to add about the difference of the relationship between the public and their military is that it doesn't just distance, but these things record all that they see. And so we have the rise of what you can call YouTube war, which is basically people take these clips, put them up on YouTube, and they send them around like entertainment. The soldiers that I spoke with, they call it war porn.
Wow. You profile iRobot and also another company called Foster Miller Company in your first chapter. What does Foster Miller do?
So Foster Miller is just like iRobot, another company started by three MIT engineers. But it's moved in a different direction. One of its signature products that some people might have heard of is called the Sword System. And it's basically a machine gun armed robot. It's about the size of a lawnmower. And as I described, this gives new meaning to the technology term killer application.
And this lawnmower just goes through some dangerous area with a machine gun at the ready and then shoots when somebody pushes a button from some distance?
Yeah, and it can be controlled either most of them are controlled. They use a radio control from a distance, so you can be several miles away. They hope ultimately to be able to put it up to control via the internet, for example. So like the Predator drones, you could be sitting thousands of miles away.
And these robots are programmed. They're not affected by anger, fear, or the desire for self-preservation. Some people might say they make better soldiers, and they can't get PTSD.
That is an argument. As some might say, you know, the human, you are the weakest link. The challenge is that robots, let's look at the issue of war crimes. A lot of war crimes happen because of human emotion. A buddy gets killed, anger takes over, and they lash out at civilians. A robot's emotionless. So some of the Pentagon folks say, you know, these things will actually be more ethical than our own soldiers. They'll be more moral.
And they won't rape. And they won't do some of the other things that we see when soldiers get upset.
You know, bad things happen in war. And they say, you know what, you can control and program these machines. But there's a flip side. You can't make a machine moral. It doesn't have empathy. It doesn't have a sense of guilt. And so to a machine, for example, 80-year-old grandmother in a wheelchair looks just the same as a T-80 tank, except for the zeros and ones are in just a little bit of a different order. And that's the thing that when I would meet with, for example, U.S. military folks out in the field, one Green Beret captain put it this way to me. He says, "This is exactly what scares the crap out of me, but it's inevitable."
There's another side, which is if warfare becomes more and more like a video game, and video games are all about the fun of shooting down as many of the enemy as possible, then as you say, there's also a disconnect. We could see all sorts of weird things happening from thousands and thousands of miles away.
Well, this is the thing, is it's not we could see.
We're seeing it already.
The point of this book is that there's a revolution happening around us and we don't talk about it. You know, one of the scenes in the book, for example, was about an airstrike in Fallujah. It was carried out by two separate drones, one targeting, the other one launched the missile. The people behind it never met face-to-face. They never even spoke over either the radio or the phone. The entire operation was carried out via internet chat room. They just texted with each other. That's with machines right now with no autonomy. What happens as you move into the next generation? Because we have to remember, these are like the Model T Fords compared to what's coming. And that's where you really get into the sci-fi turning real questions.
My guest is P.W. Singer, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's worked for the Pentagon as well as consulted for the Departments of Defense and State, the CIA, and Congress. He's written a book called Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century. It is published by Penguin Press. When you talk to people in the Pentagon and at State, et cetera, do you talk about your misgivings about this?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I would ask these questions. I ask hard questions. One, for example, is the issue of the laws of war. How do we take laws of war that were written, you know, back in when the biggest invention was, 45 RPM record, and apply them to this kind of Star Trek-like technology? And there were two sort of scenes in the book that jump out to me that I think are fascinating. One was when I went to the International Red Cross, which is where the sort of guidelines of international law come from. And they said, you know, look, it's not that we're not aware of all these new systems. It's that there's so much bad going on in the world, we don't have the time to deal with them. And that's kind of the same thing we could have said about atomic bombs, and we're saying that now. The other incident, real quickly, was a Pentagon robotics scientist who said, you know what, there's nothing to worry about the law or ethics of these machines. That is, unless they kill the wrong people repeatedly, then it's just a product recall issue. And I was like, wow, that's...
But that's kind of like the argument for collateral damage being something that we just have to expect. A recent New York Times article profiled Ronald Arkin, a Georgia Tech professor who's developing governors to regulate combat robots' moral judgment. Do you think that that might succeed?
They think, again, they can make these machines more moral, more ethical, but the reality is that a machine is still driven by a series of zeros and ones. The other part of this is that it's not just the ethics of the machines. It's the ethics of the people behind the machines that matter a great deal. What can you build? Who should own them? Who should control them? And then a big thing, for example, is who is held responsible when things go wrong? So one robot executive described to me of saying, we have these things called oops moments. And I was like, well, what are oops moments? Give me a couple examples of those. Well, a funny oops moment is they were testing out a machine gun armed robot, and it started spinning and pointed its gun at the reviewing stand of VIPs. And fortunately, it didn't have any bullets in it, and that was, you know, no one was hurt. But other times, there are incidents where people are hurt. For example, we had three separate incidents so far of what you could call unmanned slaughter. That is, just like in software where it's garbage in, garbage out, the same thing with software and war. Three times we thought we got bin Laden with one of these drone strikes, and it turned out not to be the case.
You're right that the Pentagon is developing tiny robots the size of flies for reconnaissance operations. This is going to give us that fly-on-the-wall capability?
Yeah, they're very much bugs with bugs, you could think about. And, you know, it's incredibly powerful, incredibly useful, for example, in finding out what a terrorist leader might be thinking. Flip side is, are we comfortable with a bug sitting on our windowsill and peering
right.
in?
There could be one right here.
And this is the other part. Again, you know, ethical question. Who gets to control these? Should it just be cut to militaries? Well, there's already police forces that are purchasing these systems.
So these sorts of things, we can assume, will also be used domestically somewhere down the line.
Well, it sounds like futuristic science fiction, but for example, the Department of Homeland Security is using the Predator drones, the same ones that were using in airstrikes into Pakistan. They're using them for border control. The LA Police Department has purchased drones. So my whole point of this is that we haven't talked about it because it often sounds like it's straight out of the movies. Well, it is, but that is the same way we thought about atomic bombs, airplanes, tanks, and then Pandora's box opened.
And you're right, science fiction is more than just popular, it's influential.
Yeah, one of the things that was very interesting in meeting with people on the military side is that they were completely open about how they would get an idea for a certain technology or system from sci-fi. One Marine colonel, for example, said, you know, I'm sitting at home watching the third Star Wars movies, and he points out a certain system. He says, that's where we got the idea for this. The other part is, remember, sci-fi shapes our ideas of what the future is going to look like. So it's great for funding. There's certain laser programs that basically Pentagon signed to say, we knew we weren't going to get funding for it unless we talked about the sci-fi element. There's one called the Phaser program.
So maybe George Lucas should go to work for the Pentagon. In the book, you mention an astrophysics term, singularity, which is a state in which things become so radically different that the old rules break down and we know virtually nothing. Is this dependence on robotics going to bring about that kind of singularity?
I think we are entering that point, particularly in war. These singularities are when all the old rules fall apart, where you have to ask questions that you wouldn't have asked before. An example would be the invention of the printing press, or in war, gunpowder, the atomic bomb. And I think historians are going to look back on this period, you know, 100 years, 500 years from now, if we're so lucky to be around, and they're going to say, you know what? Breaking the 5,000-year-old human monopoly on war, that's kind of a big deal. And what I hope to do is go around and capture the stories of everyone who was playing in that game right now.
Is this basically an American thing, or is there a robotics arms race?
No, that's one of the other things that history tells us, is that there's no permanent first-mover advantages. That's true whether you're talking about technology. You know, none of us use Wang computers right now. And it's also true whether you're talking about war. You know, the gunpowder revolution, it was the Chinese who invented it, but it was the Europeans who won it. And in robotics, we're ahead right now, but there's 43 other countries that are working on military robotics programs, everything from Iran and Pakistan to China and Russia. And then the other part of this that's an interesting twist in our strange world is that it's going to be open source. It is a technology that isn't built out in secret desert labs. A lot of it is commercial off the shelf, or you can do it yourself. For $1,000, you can put together the equivalent of a Raven drone, which is what the soldiers use in Iraq. And that means I can do it, you can do it. But there's also been interest in this among terrorist groups. And so it puts a new wrinkle on the terrorism game and may even cause new sparks of terrorism. One of the people that I interviewed for the book was Richard Clark, the government official who famously warned about 9/11. And I asked him about where this trend was taking us. And he worried that it was going to create new sparks of violence, people who were so upset about all this overwhelming change that they'd lash out in violence. He kind of summed it up as saying the future is Al-Qaeda 2.0 and the Unabomber.
And you also say that robots really carry out our preconceptions about an enemy, which in a way that we might not act out on if we were there, because we might have conflicting thoughts.
Yeah, the big part of this is how so much of the impact of robotics we're seeing is actually driven by human psychology. And it's strange to say that, but it's the reality of it. And one of the things that's fascinated me is, what is the message we think we are sending with this greater and greater use of unmanned systems versus what is being received? So I went around and, you know, for example, I met with a Bush administration official and said, you know, what do you think the other side's getting by our use of these? And he said, you know, it plays to our strength. Quote, the thing that scares people is our technology. But then I went out and interviewed people in Lebanon and Pakistan, and it's a very different message they're receiving. And there's a great quote from a news editor in Lebanon, and he's sitting in Beirut while there's actually a drone flying overhead. And he describes it as this way, quote, it's just another sign of the cold-hearted, cruel Israelis and Americans who are cowards because they send out machines to fight us. They don't want to fight us like real men. So you have this disconnect between the two messages, and it's something we got to figure out.
Dr. Peter W. Singer is a fellow at the Brookings Institution and has worked in the Pentagon as well as consulted for the Departments of Defense and State, the CIA, and Congress. He's the author of Corporate Warriors and Children at War, and he's also written for publications like the New York Times and Foreign Affairs. And he will be at the Carnegie Council at 170 East 64th Street Thursday, February 5th, this coming Thursday, a week from, what, tomorrow? For today. That's at 5:30. His book is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.